In 1867, Charles Dickens made a triumphal speaking tour of the United States. One of his most popular readings was A Christmas Carol. In 1904, a young graduate student in Boston found an actual script from Dickens' readings. Later, as a professor at the College of Worcester in Ohio, and using the old script, he read A Christmas Carol there every year for 50 years. As a young undergraduate at Worcester, Willem Lang fell in love with the story in 1955, and in 1975 began his own series of annual readings. Here he is in a special edition of the Dickens Classic.
Marley was dead, to begin with. There was no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial had been signed by the clergyman, the clerk, and the undertaker. Scrooge signed it, and Scrooge's name was good for whatever he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead. Oh, why, yes, of course he did. How could it be otherwise? He and Marley had been partners for, I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, his sole friend, his sole mourner. But nobody ever bothered to paint out old Marley's name. There it stood, years afterward, above the warehouse door. Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge Scrooge, sometimes Marley, but he answered to either one. It was all the same to him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge. A squeezing, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. External heat and cold had little influence on him. No warmth could warm, no cold could chill him. Nobody ever stopped him on the street to say with gladsome looks, "My dear Scrooge, how are you? When are you coming over to see us?" No beggars ever implored him to bestow a trifle. No children ever asked him what it was o'clock. What did Scrooge care? To edge his way along the crowded paths of life, warning all human sympathy to keep its distance, was the very thing he liked. Well, once upon a time, of all good days in the year, upon a Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was damp, cold, bleak, biting weather, and the city clocks had only just gone three, but it was quite dark outside already. Now, the fire in Scrooge's room was very small, but that of his clerk was so much smaller that it resembled one coal, and yet he dared not replenish it. For Scrooge kept the scuttle in his own room, and as surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Whereupon the clerk put on his long comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle, an attempt in which, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed. "A Merry Christmas, Uncle!" It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who'd come upon him so suddenly that this was the first intimation Scrooge had had of his approach.
"Ah, humbug!"
"Christmas a humbug, Uncle? I'm sure you don't mean it."
"I'm sure I do mean it. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying bills without any money? A time for balancing your books and finding a round dozen of months presented dead against you, eh? If I had my way, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips would be boiled in his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart, he would."
"Uncle."
"Nephew, so you keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine."
"Why, keep it? But you don't keep it."
"Well, let me leave it alone, then. Much good may it do you. Much good has it ever done you."
"Well, there are many things from which I have derived good, by which I have not profited. I dare say Christmas among the rest. But I've always thought of Christmas time as a good time, the only time I know of in the long calendar of the year when men and women seem by one consent to open their shut-up hearts and to think of people below them as fellow passengers to the grave, and not another race of creatures bound on other journeys. And therefore, Uncle, though it has never put a scrap of gold in my pocket, I believe it has done me good, and will do me good,
and I say, God bless it.
You're quite a powerful speaker, sir. I wonder you don't go into Parliament.
Don't be angry, Uncle. Come dine with us tomorrow. Scrooge said that he would see him first in hell. Yes, indeed, he did. But why, Uncle?
Why did you get married?
Well, because I fell in love.
Because you fell in love?
Good afternoon. Nay, Uncle, but you never came to see me before that happened. Why give it as a reason for not coming now?
Good afternoon.
I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why cannot we be friends?
Good afternoon.
Well, I'm sorry with all my heart to find you so obdurate, but I'll keep my Christmas humor to the last. So, Merry Christmas, Uncle.
Good afternoon.
His nephew left the room without an angry word notwithstanding. Now the clerk, in letting Scrooge's nephew out, had let two other people in. They were portly gentlemen, pleasant to behold, and now stood with their hats off in Scrooge's office. They held books and papers under their arms.
Scrooge and Marley's, I believe. Have I the pleasure of addressing Mr. Scrooge or Mr. Marley?
Mr. Marley is dead. He died 7 years ago, this very night.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it is desirable that we make some provision for the poor and destitute who suffer greatly at the present time. Many thousands are in want of common necessaries, sir.
Are there no prisons?
Oh, plenty, but they scarcely furnish any cheer to the unoffending multitude. So a few of us are raising a fund to buy the poor some meat and drink and means of warmth. We choose this time because it is a time when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices. What shall I put you down for?
Nothing.
You wish to be anonymous.
I wish to be left alone. Since you ask what I wish, gentlemen, that is my answer. I don't make merry myself at Christmas, and I can't afford to make idle people merry. I help to support the prisons and the workhouses, and those who are badly off must go there.
Well, many can't go there, and some would rather die.
Well, if they'd rather die, then they'd better get on with it. Decrease the surplus population.
At length the hour of shutting up the counting-house arrived. With an ill will, Scrooge dismounted from his stool and tacitly admitted the fact to his expectant clerk, who instantly snuffed his candle out and put on his hat.
You'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose.
Well, if it's convenient, sir.
It's not convenient, and it's not fair. You'd think yourself mighty ill-used, I'll be bound, if I's to stop your wages half a crown for it.
Yes, sir.
But you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work?
Well, it's only once a year, sir.
A poor excuse for picking a man's pocket. But I suppose you must have the whole day.
Be here all the earlier next morning, you hear? The clerk promised that he would, and Scrooge walked out with a growl. The office was closed in a twinkling, and the clerk went down a slide at the end of a lane of boys in Cornhill 20 times in honor of its being Christmas Eve, then ran for home as hard as he could pelt to play at blind man's buff.
Scrooge took his usual dinner in his usual melancholy tavern,
and having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, he went home to bed. He lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner, a gloomy suite of rooms in a lowering pile of a building up a yard. Now, it is a fact that there was nothing at all particular about the knocker of Scrooge's door, except that it was very large, and that Scrooge had seen it night and morning during his entire residence in the place. Also that Scrooge had as little of what is called a fancy about him as any man in London, and yet Scrooge, having his key in the lock, saw in the knocker, without its undergoing any intermediate process of change, not a knocker, but Marley's face.
Marley's face, with a dim light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar. It looked as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up on its ghostly forehead. As Scrooge stared fixedly at this phenomenon, it faded and was a knocker again. He put his hand upon the key he had relinquished, turned it sturdily, walked in, and lighted his candle. He did pause before he shut the door, and he did look cautiously behind it, as if he half expected to see Marley's pigtail sticking out into the hall. But there was nothing on the back of the door except the nuts that held the knocker on. So he said, "Pooh!" and closed it with a bang. The sound resounded through the house like thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellar below seemed to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He fastened the door and walked across the hall and up the stairs, trimming his candle as he went and not caring a button for its being very dark. Darkness is cheap, and Scrooge liked it. But before he shut his door, he walked through his rooms to see that all was right. He had just enough recollection of the face to desire to do that. Sitting room, bedroom as they should be. Nobody under the table. Nobody under the sofa. Nobody under the bed. Nobody in the closet. Nobody in his dressing gown, which was hanging up in a suspicious attitude against the wall. Quite satisfied, he closed his door and locked himself in. Double-locked himself in, which was not his custom. Thus secured against surprise, he took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers and his nightcap, and sat down before the fire to take some gruel. As he sat back in the chair, his glance happened to rest upon a bell, a disused bell that hung in the room and communicated with a chamber in the highest part of the building. It was with great astonishment and a strange inexplicable dread that as he looked, he saw this bell begin to swing. Soon it rang out loudly, and so did every bell in the house. This was succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain over the cask in the wine merchant's cellar. The cellar door flew open with a booming sound, and then he heard the noise much louder on the floors below, then coming up the stairs, then coming straight toward his door. On it came, without a pause, through the heavy door, and a specter passed into the room. Upon its coming in, the dying flame leapt up as though it cried, "I know him! Marley's ghost!" Same face, the very same. Jacob Marley in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights, and boots. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, looking at him and through him, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he'd never believed it till now. Nor did he believe it even now, though he looked the phantom through and through and marked the very texture of the kerchief which it wore about its head and chin.
"Oreo,
ask me who I was."
Marley's voice, no doubt about it. "Well, who were you then?"
"In life, I was your partner, Jacob Marley."
Can you sit down?"
"I can."
"Do it, then."
Scrooge asked the question because he didn't know whether a ghost so transparent might find itself in a condition to take a chair. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace as if he were quite accustomed to it.
"You don't believe in me?"
"No, no, I don't."
"Why do you doubt your senses?"
"Well, because a very slight thing affects them. You might be an undigested bit of beef, a crumb of cheese, or a fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are."
Now, Scrooge was not much in the habit of cracking jokes,
nor did he feel in his heart by any means waggish then. The truth is that he tried to be smart as a means of distracting his own attention and keeping down his terror. But how much greater was his horror when, the ghost taking off the bandage round his head, as if it were too warm to wear indoors, his lower jaw dropped down upon his breast.
"Mercy! Dreadful apparition! Why do you trouble me?"
"It is required of every man that the spirit within him should walk abroad among his fellow men and travel far and wide. And if that spirit goes not forth in life, it is condemned to do so after death. Oh, I cannot tell you what I would. Very little time is permitted to me. I cannot rest. I cannot stay. I cannot linger anywhere. Mark me. In life, my spirit never roved beyond the limits of our money-changing hole, and weary journeys lie before me."
"You, travel fast, Jacob?"
"On the wings of the wind."
"7 years dead and traveling all the time, you must have got over a great quantity of ground."
"Oh, blind man, not to know that any kindly spirit, working in his little sphere, will find its mortal life too short for its vast means of usefulness. Yet such was I."
But you were always a good man of business, Jacob."
"Business? Mankind was my business. The common welfare was my business. The dealings of my trade were but a drop of water in the comprehensive ocean of my business. So hear me, Ebenezer, my time is nearly gone."
"But I will, but don't be hard on me. Don't be flowery, Jacob, pray."
"I am here tonight to warn you that you have yet a chance and hope of escaping my fate. A chance and hope of my procuring Ebenezer.
You were always a good friend to me. Thank you."
"You will be haunted by three spirits."
"Is that the chance and hope you mentioned, Jacob?"
I think I'd rather not."
"Without their coming, you cannot hope to shun the path I tread. Expect the first tonight when the bell tolls one. Expect the second on the next night at the same hour. The third upon the third night when the last stroke of 12 has ceased to vibrate. Look to see me no more, and look that for your own sake you remember what has passed between us."
When he had said these words, he got up and walked backward from Scrooge, and at every step he took, the window raised itself a little, so that when the spectre reached it, it was wide open. Then the ghost, with a last wave of admonition, floated through the opening into the bleak, dark night. Scrooge closed the window and examined the door by which the ghost had entered. It was double-locked as he'd locked it with his own hands, and the bolts were undisturbed. He tried to say, "Humbug," but stopped at the first syllable. And being from the emotion he had undergone, or the fatigues of the day, or the lateness of the hour, much in need of repose, he went straight to bed without undressing and fell asleep on the instant. When Scrooge awoke, it was so dark that he could scarcely distinguish the transparent window from the opaque walls of his chamber. Suddenly the church bell tolled a deep, dull, hollow, melancholy one. Light flashed up in the room upon the instant, and the curtains of his bed were drawn aside by a strange figure, like a child, yet not so like a child as like an old man. Its hair, which hung about its neck and down its back, was white, as if with age, and yet the face had not a wrinkle in it, and the tenderest bloom was on the skin. It held a branch of fresh green holly in its hand, and in singular contradiction of that wintry emblem had the dress trimmed with summer flowers.
"Are you the spirit, sir, whose coming was foretold to me?"
"I am."
"Who and what are you?"
"I am the ghost of Christmas past."
What business brought you here? Your welfare. Rise and walk with me. It would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted for pedestrian purposes, that the thermometer was a long way below freezing, and that he was clad but lightly in his slippers, dressing gown, and nightcap. The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit made toward the window, clasped its robe in supplication. I am a mortal, and liable to fall. Bear but a touch of my hand there, said the spirit, laying it upon his heart, and you shall be upheld in more than this. As the words were spoken, they passed through the wall and stood upon the busy thoroughfares of a great city. It was Christmas Eve. Scrooge and the ghost passed on invisible and stopped at a certain warehouse door. The ghost asked Scrooge if he knew it.
Know it? Why wasn't I apprenticed here?
They went in. At the sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig, sitting behind such a high desk that if he'd been 2 inches taller he must have knocked his head against the ceiling, Scrooge cried out in great excitement, Why, it's old Fezziwig! Oh, bless his heart! It's Fezziwig, alive again! Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and looked up at the clock, which pointed to the hour of 7. He rubbed his hands, adjusted his capacious waistcoat, laughed all over himself, and called out, Yo-ho there! Ebenezer! Dick! Scrooge's former self, a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow apprentice, Dick Wilkins. Christmas Eve, Dick! Christmas, Ebenezer! Let's have the shutters up before a man can say Jack Robinson! Clear away, my lads! Let's have lots of room here! Clear away? Why, there was nothing they wouldn't have cleared away, or couldn't have cleared away, with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. The floor was swept and watered, the lamps were trimmed, fuel was heaped upon the fire, and the warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler with a music-book, and went up to the lofty desk, made an orchestra of it, and tuned like 50 stomach aches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig, one vast, substantial smile. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In came the housemaid with her cousin, the baker. In came the cook with her brother's particular friend, the milkman. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some gracefully, some awkwardly, some pushing, some pulling. In they all came anyhow. Away they all went, 20 couples at once, hands half round and back again the other way. Down the middle and up again, old top couple always turning up in the wrong place, new top couple starting off again as soon as they got there, all top couples at last, and not a bottom one to help them. When this result was reached, old Fezziwig, clapping his hands to stop the dance, cried out, Well done! And the fiddler plunged his face into a pot of porter, especially provided for the purpose. Then there were forfeits, and there was cake and negus, and there was a great piece of cold roast and mince pies and plenty of beer. But the great effect of the evening came after the cold roast and boiled, when the fiddler struck up Sir Roger de Coverley. Then old Fezziwig stood out to dance with Mrs. Fezziwig. Top couple, too, with a good stiff piece of work cut out for them. 3 or 4 and 20 pairs of partners. But if they had been twice as many, 4 times, old Fezziwig would have been a match for them. A positive light appeared to issue from his calves. You couldn't have predicted at any given time what would become of them next. And when old Fezziwig and Mrs. Fezziwig had gone all through the dance, advance and retire, bow and courtesy, thread the needle and back to your place, Fezziwig cut, and cut so deftly that he appeared to wink with his legs. When the clock struck 11, this domestic ball broke up.
Mr. and Mrs. Fezziwig took their stations, one on either side of the door, and shaking hands with every person as he or she went out, wished him or her a Merry Christmas. "A small matter," said the ghost, "to make these silly folks so full of gratitude. He has spent but a few pounds of your mortal money. Is that so much that he deserves all this praise?"
"Well, it isn't that, Spirit, it isn't that. He had the power to make our service light or burdensome. Say that his effect lies in words and looks, in things so slight that it's impossible to count 'em. What then? The happiness he gives is quite as great as if it cost a fortune."
"What's the matter?" asked the ghost.
"I should like to be able to say a word to my clerk just now, that's all."
"My time grows short," observed the spirit. "Quick." This was not addressed to Scrooge, but it produced an immediate effect, for again Scrooge saw himself. He was older now, a man in the prime of life. He was sitting by the side of a fair young girl in whose eyes there were tears. "It matters little," she said softly, "to you very little. Another idol has displaced me. And if it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, as I would have tried to do, I have no just cause to grieve."
What idol has displaced you?"
"A golden one. You fear the world too much. I have seen your noble aspirations fall off one by one, until the master passion, gain, engrosses you. Have I not?"
"Well, what if I have grown so much wiser? What then? I'm not changed toward you.
Have I ever sought release from our engagement?" "In words? No, never."
"Well, in what then?"
"In a changed nature, in an altered spirit. If you were free today, can even I believe that you would choose a dowerless girl? Do I not know that your repentance and regret would surely follow?" "I do, and I release you, with a full heart, for the love of him you once were."
"Spirit! Remove me from this place."
"I told you that these were shadows of the things that have been. That they are what they are. Do not blame me.
Remove me. I cannot bear it. Take me back and haunt me no longer."
As he struggled with the spirit, he was conscious of being exhausted, and further, of being in his own bedroom. He had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep. Scrooge awoke in his own room, but it had undergone a transformation. The walls and ceiling were so hung with living green that it looked a perfect grove, and such a mighty blaze went roaring up the chimney as that dull petrifaction of a hearth had never known in Scrooge's time, or Marley's, or for many and many a winter season gone. Heaped up on the floor to form a kind of throne were turkeys, game, great joints of meat, sucking pigs, mince pies, barrels of oysters, red-hot chestnuts, apples, and seething bowls of punch that made the chamber dim with their delicious steam. In easy state upon this throne there sat a jolly giant, glorious to see, who bore a glowing torch and held it high up to shed its light on Scrooge as he came peeping round the door.
"Come in, come in, and know me better, man. I am the ghost of Christmas present. Look upon me. You've never seen the like of me before."
"No, never."
"Have never walked forth with my elder brothers?"
"Well, I don't think I have. Have you had many brothers, Spirit?"
"Oh, more than 1,800.
"What a tremendous family to provide for. Spirit, conduct me where you will. I went forth last night, and I learned a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it."
"Touch my robe."
Scrooge did as he was bid. The room and its contents vanished instantly, and they stood in the busy thoroughfares of a great city on a snowy Christmas morning. Scrooge and the ghost passed on invisible to Scrooge's clerk's house, and on the threshold of the door the spirit smiled and stopped to bless Bob Cratchit's dwelling. Then up rose Mrs. Cratchit, Bob's wife, dressed out but poorly in a twice-turned gown, but brave in ribbons, which are cheap and make a goodly show for sixpence, and she laid the cloth, assisted by Belinda Cratchit, while Master Peter Cratchit plunged a fork into the saucepan of potatoes, and getting the corners of his monstrous shirt-collar, his father's private property conferred upon his son in honor of the day, into his mouth, rejoiced to find himself so gallantly attired, and yearned to show his linen in the fashionable parks. And now the two smaller Cratchits, boy and girl, came tearing in, screaming that outside the baker's they had smelt the goose and known it for their own, and basking in luxurious thoughts of sage and onion, these young Cratchits danced about the table while Master Peter blew the fire until the slow potatoes bubbling up knocked loudly at the saucepan lid to be let out and peeled. "And what has got your father, then?" said Mrs. Cratchit. "And your brother Tiny Tim and Martha weren't as late last Christmas Day by half an hour."
"Here's Martha, mother," cried the two young Cratchits. "Hurrah! There's such a goose, Martha!"
"Why, bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are. Well, never mind as long as you're come. Sit you down by the fire, my dear, and have a warm, Lord bless you."
"No, no, there's father coming," cried the two young Cratchits, who were everywhere at once. "Hide, Martha, hide!"
So Martha hid herself, and in came Bob, the father, with 3 feet of comforter hanging down before him, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Oh, alas for Tiny Tim. He bore a little crutch, and had his limbs supported by an iron frame. "Why, where's our Martha?" cried Bob Cratchit, looking round. "Not coming."
"Not coming? Not coming upon Christmas Day?"
Martha couldn't stand to see him disappointed, even if only in joke. So she came out from behind the closet door and ran into his arms, while the two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim off into the wash-house to hear the pudding singing in the copper. And how did little Tim behave? Oh, good as gold and better, too. Somehow he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much, and he thinks the strangest things. He told me that he hoped the people saw him in the church, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men see. His active little crutch was heard upon the floor, and back came Tiny Tim, escorted by his brother and sister, to his stool beside the fire. And while Bob compounded some hot mixture in a jug with gin and lemons, and stirred it round and round, Master Peter and the two young Cratchits went to fetch the goose, with which they soon returned in high procession. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy, hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce. Martha dusted the hot plates. Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a little corner at the table. The two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their stools, crammed spoons into their mouths, lest they should shriek for goose before their turn came to be helped. At last the dishes were set on, and grace was said. It was succeeded by a breathless pause, as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it into the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all around the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two young Cratchits, beat on the table with the handle of his knife and feebly cried, "Hurrah!" There never was such a goose. Its tenderness and flavor, size and cheapness, were the themes of universal admiration. Eked out by applesauce and mashed potatoes, it was a sufficient dinner for the whole family. Everyone had enough, and the youngest Cratchits in particular were steeped in sage and onions to the eyebrows. But now Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it back in. Suppose it should not be done enough. Suppose it should break in turning out.
Suppose somebody should have gotten over the wall of the backyard and stolen it while they were merry with the goose? A supposition at which the two young Cratchits became livid.
Hello? A great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper.
A smell like a washing day. That was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other with a laundress's next door to that.
Oh, that was the pudding. In half a minute Mrs. Cratchit entered, flushed and smiling proudly, with the pudding, like a speckled cannonball so hard and firm, blazing in half a quartern of ignited brandy, and bedight with Christmas holly stuck into the top.
Ho-ho, a wonderful pudding. Bob Cratchit said, and calmly, too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. At last the dinner was done, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. Then the family drew round the hearth in a half-circle. At Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. These held the hot stuff from the jug, however, as well as golden goblets would have done, and Bob served it out with beaming looks. "A Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. God bless us!" which all the family re-echoed.
"God bless us, everyone!" said Tiny Tim, the last of all.
He sat very close to his father's side upon his little stool. Bob held his withered little hand in his, as if he loved the child and wished to keep him by his side, and dreaded that he might be taken from him.
"Spirit," said Scrooge, "tell me that the child will live."
"I see a vacant seat in the chimney corner," replied the ghost, "and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, the child will die. But what of it? If he be like to die, he had better do it and decrease the surplus population."
Scrooge bent before the ghost's rebuke, but raised his head on hearing his own name.
"Mr. Scrooge," cried Bob Cratchit, "I'll give you a toast to Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast."
"The founder of the feast, indeed," replied Mrs. Cratchit. "I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of me mind to feast upon.
Now, my dear, the children, Christmas Day."
"Well, it should be Christmas Day, I'm sure, when one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. You know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it better than you do, poor fellow."
"My dear, Christmas Day, the children...
Well, I'll drink his health for the day's sake, but not for his. Long life to him. A happy New Year. He'll be very merry and happy, I have no doubt."
The children drank the toast after her, but it was the first of their proceedings which had no heartiness in it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mere mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for a full 5 minutes. After it passed away, they were 10 times heartier than before, from the mere relief of Scrooge the Baleful being done with. Bob told them how he had a situation in his eye for Master Peter, which would bring in, if attained, full 5 and 6 pence weekly. Martha, who was a poor prentice at a milliner's, then told how she meant to lie abed tomorrow morning for a long rest. All this time the chestnuts in the jug went round and round, and by they had a song from Tiny Tim, who had a plaintive little voice, and sang it very well indeed. Now, there was nothing of high mark in this. They were not a handsome family. They were not well dressed. Their shoes were far from waterproof. But they were happy, pleased with one another, and contented with their lot. And when they faded, and looked happier yet in the bright sprinkling of the spirit's torch, Scrooge had his eye upon them, and especially upon Tiny Tim, until the last. It was a great surprise to Scrooge, as the scene vanished, to hear a hearty laugh, and to find himself in a bright, dry, gleaming room, looking at his nephew, Fred. Now, it is an even-handed adjustment of things that, while there is infection and disease and sorrow,
There is nothing in the world so irresistibly contagious as laughter and good humor. When Scrooge's nephew laughed, Scrooge's niece, by marriage, laughed as heartily as he, and their assembled friends, being not a bit behindhand, roared out lustily. Ha! Ha! He said that Christmas was a humbug, and he believed it, too. More shame for him, Fred.
Well, he's a comical old fellow, said Fred, and not so pleasant as he might be, but I have nothing to say against him. Here he takes it into his head to dislike us, and he won't come and dine with us. What's the consequence? He doesn't lose much of a dinner.
Oh, indeed, I think he loses a very good dinner.
Everyone else said the same, and they must be allowed to have been competent judges because they had just had dinner, and with dessert upon the table were clustered round the fire by lamplight.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it, because I haven't any great faith in these young newlywed housekeepers.
What do you say, Topper?
Now, Topper had clearly got his eye upon one of Scrooge's niece's sisters,
for he answered that a bachelor was a wretched outcast who had no right to express an opinion on the subject. Whereat Scrooge's niece's sister, the plump one with the lace tucker, blushed.
Well, after dinner, they had some music. Well, they were a musical family and knew what they were about when they sung a glee or a catch, especially Topper, who could growl away in the bass like a good one and never swell the large veins in his forehead or get red in the face over it. But they didn't devote the whole evening to music. After a while, they had some games, for it's good to be children sometimes, and never better than at Christmas, whose mighty founder was a little child himself. There was first a game at Blind Man's Buff. But I no more believe that Topper was really blind than I believe he had eyes in his boots, for the way he went after that plump sister in the lace tucker was an outrage on the credulity of human nature. Knocking down the fire irons, tumbling over the chairs, bumping up against the piano, smothering himself among the curtains. Wherever she went, there went he. He wouldn't catch anybody else. Why, if you had fallen up against him, as some of them did, on purpose, he would have made a feint of endeavoring to seize you, which would have been an affront to your understanding, and instantly have sided off in the direction of the plump sister. Scrooge had imperceptibly become so gay and light of heart that he would have drunk the health of this unconscious company. But the whole scene passed off, and he and the spirit were again upon their travels. Much they saw, and far they went, and many homes they visited. The spirit stood beside sick beds, and they were cheerful. On foreign lands, and they were close at home. By poverty, and it was rich. In almshouse, hospital, and jail, in misery's every refuge, where vain man in his brief authority had not made fast the door and barred the spirit out, he left his blessing and taught Scrooge his precepts. As they stood together in an open place, the clock struck 12. As the last stroke ceased to vibrate, Scrooge remembered the prediction of Jacob Marley, and lifting up his eyes, beheld a solemn phantom, draped and hooded, coming like a mist along the ground toward him. When it came near him, Scrooge bent down upon his knee. "I am in the presence of the ghost of Christmas yet to come. Ghost of the future, I fear you more than any specter I have seen, but as I know your purpose is to do me good, and as I hope to live to be another man from what I was, I am prepared to bear you company, and do it with a thankful heart. Will you not speak to me?" It gave him no reply. "Lead on, lead on. The night is waning fast, and it is precious time to me, I know. Lead on, spirit." The city seemed to spring up about them. There they were, in the heart of it, on change, among the merchants. The spirit stopped beside one little knot of business men. Observing that the hand was pointed to them, Scrooge advanced to listen to their talk.
"Now, I don't know much about it either way. I only know he's dead."
"When did he die? Oh, last night, I believe.
What was the matter with him? I thought he'd never die.
God knows.
What's he done with his money?
I haven't heard. He hasn't left it to me, that's all I know. Bye-bye.
They left that busy place and went into an obscure part of town, to a low, dark shop where rags, scrap iron, bones, and greasy offal were bought and sold. A gray-haired rascal of great age sat smoking his pipe. Scrooge and the Phantom came into the presence of this man just as a woman with a heavy bundle slunk into the shop. Scrooge's charwoman. But she had scarcely entered when another woman came in too, Scrooge's laundress, Mrs. Dilber. After a period of blank astonishment, in which the old man with the pipe joined them, they all three burst into a laugh.
"Ha-ha! Look here, Joe! Here's a coincidence!" cried the charwoman. "If we ain't met here without meaning it!"
"Well, you couldn't have met in a better place. You've been here many times, you know, and Mrs. Dilber ain't a stranger.
What do you got to sell?"
"Half a minute's patience, Joe, and you shall see."
The charwoman threw her bundle on the floor and sat down in a flaunting manner on a stool, crossing her elbows on her knees and looking with a bold defiance at the other two.
"What odds, then? What odds, Mrs. Dilber? Every person has a right to take care of themselves." "Oh, my, yes," said the laundress. "Who's the worse for the loss of a few things like these? Not a dead man, I suppose." "No, indeed. If he wanted to keep 'em after he was dead, why wasn't he natural in his lifetime? If he had been, he'd have had somebody to look after him when he was struck with death, instead of lying there, gasping out his last, alone, by himself." "It's the truest word that was ever spoke. It's a judgment on him." "Well, it should have been a much heavier one if I could have laid me hands on anything else. Open that bundle, Joe, and let me know the value of it."
Old Joe went down on his knees and dragged out a heavy roll of some dark stuff.
What do you call this?
Bed curtains?" "Aye, bed curtains."
"You don't mean to say you took 'em down, rings and all, with him lying there?"
"Yes, I do. Why not?"
"You were born to make your fortune, love, and so you shall, so you shall."
"Don't step on them blankets now."
"Whose is?"
"Who else's, do you think? He ain't likely to take cold without 'em, I dare say." "And you won't find a hole in that shirt. It's the best he had. They'd have wasted it if it hadn't been for me, by dressing him up in it to be buried."
Scrooge listened to this dialogue in horror.
"Spirit, I see. The case of this unhappy man, it might be my own. My life tends that way now. Merciful heavens! Hey, what's this?"
He recoiled in terror, for the scene had changed, and now he almost touched a bed, a bare, uncurtained bed. A pale light rising in the outer air fell straight upon the bed, and on it, plundered and bereft, unwatched, unwept, uncared for, was the body of this man.
"Spirit, let me see some tenderness connected with the death, or this dark chamber will be forever present to me."
The ghost conducted him to Bob Cratchit's house, the dwelling he had visited before, and found the mother and the children seated round the fire. The mother was sewing a suit of grave clothes, a very small suit. She laid it upon the table.
"Oh, the color hurts my eyes," she said.
"The color? Ah, poor Tiny Tim."
"It makes them weak by candlelight, and I wouldn't show weak eyes to your father when he comes home for the world. It must be near his time."
"Past it, rather, but I think he's walked a little slower of late than he used to, mother," said Belinda. "I've known him walk with Tiny Tim upon his shoulder very fast indeed," said Peter.
"Oh, but he was very light to carry, and his father loved him so that it was no trouble. Ah, here's your father now."
She hurried out to meet him, and little Bob came in. His tea was ready for him on the hob, and they all tried who should help him to it most. The two young Cratchits got up on his knees and laid each child a little cheek against his face, as if they said, "Don't mind it, Father. Don't be grieved." Bob was very cheerful with them. He looked at the work upon the table and praised the industry and speed of Mrs. Cratchit and the girls. They would be done long before Sunday, he said. "Sunday? You went to the churchyard today, then, Robert?" "Yes, my dear. I wish you could have gone. It would have done you good to see how green a place it is. You know, I promised him that I would walk there of a Sunday." "Oh, my little child. Oh, God. My little child." He broke down all at once. He couldn't help it, poor fellow. If he could have helped it, he and his child would have been farther apart than they were. "Spectre, something tells me that our parting is at hand. I know it, but I know not how. Tell me what man that was whom we saw lying dead." The ghost conducted him to a dismal, ruinous, wretched churchyard, stood among the graves, and pointed down to one. "Before I draw nearer to that stone, answer me one question. Are these the shadows of things that will be, or shadows of things that may be only?" Still the ghost pointed downward to the grave by which it stood. "Men's courses will foreshadow certain ends to which, if persevered in, they must lead. But if the courses be departed from, the ends will change. Say it is thus with what you show me." The spirit was immovable as ever. Scrooge crept toward it, trembling as he went, and following the finger, read the stone of the neglected grave. "Ebenezer Scrooge, am I the man who lay upon that bed? No, no, spirit, I am not the man I was. I will not be the man I must have been but for this intercourse. Why show me this if I am past all hope?" For the first time the hand appeared to falter. "I will honor Christmas in my heart and try to keep it all the year. The spirits of past, present, and future shall strive within me. Oh, tell me that I may sponge away the writing on this stone." Holding up his hands in a last prayer to have his fate reversed, he saw an alteration in the phantom's hood and dress. It shrank, collapsed, and dwindled down into a bedpost. Yes, and the bedpost was his own. The room was his own. Best and happiest of all, the time was his own to make amends in. Running to the window, he opened it and stuck out his head. No fog, no mist. Bright, clear, jovial, golden sunshine.
"What's today, me fine fella?"
cried Scrooge, calling down to a boy in Sunday clothes.
"Today? Why, it's Christmas Day!"
"It's Christmas? I haven't missed it. The spirits have done their work in one night instead of three."
"Hello, me fine fella. Hello. Say, do you know the Poulterers in the next street but one at the corner?" "I should hope I did."
"An intelligent boy, a remarkable boy. Do you know whether they've sold the prize turkey that was hanging up there? Not the little prize turkey, the big one."
"What, the one as big as me?"
"Yes, me buck.
It's hanging there now."
"Is it? Go and buy it."
"What?
No, no, no. I'm in earnest. Go and buy it and tell him to bring it here that I may give him directions where to take it. Come back with the man and I'll give you a shilling. Come back with him in less than 5 minutes, and I'll give you half a crown."
The boy was off like a shot. "I'll send it to Bob Cratchit. He shan't know who sent it. It's twice the size of Tiny Tim." The hand in which he wrote the address was not a steady one, but write it he did somehow, and went downstairs to await the coming of the poulterer's man.
Ho, 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 ho! It was a turkey, that bird. He never could have stood upon his legs. He would have snapped them off short in a minute like sticks of sealing wax.
At last he got himself dressed all in his best and out into the streets. Walking along with his hands behind him, Scrooge looked so irresistibly pleasant that three or four good-humoured fellows said, "Good morning, sir, a Merry Christmas to you." And Scrooge said often afterward that of all the blithe sounds he had ever heard, those were the blithest. In the afternoon he made his way to his nephew's house. He passed the door a dozen times before he had the courage to go up and knock. But at last he made a dash, and he did it.
"Why, bless my soul, who's that?"
"It's I, your Uncle Scrooge. I've come to dinner. Will you let me in, Fred?"
"Let him in? Why, it's a mercy he didn't shake his arm off. He was at home in 5 minutes. Nothing could be heartier. His niece looked just the same. So did Topper when he came. So did the plump sister when she came. So did everyone when they came. Wonderful party, wonderful games, wonderful unanimity, wonderful happiness."
Oh, but he was early at the office next morning. If he could only be there first and catch Bob Cratchit coming in late, that was the thing he set his heart upon. And he did it. The clock struck 9. No Bob. 1:15. No Bob. Bob Cratchit was full 18 minutes and a half behind his time. His hat was off before he opened the door. He was on his stool in a jiffy, driving away with his pen as if he were trying to overtake 9 o'clock.
"Hello," growled Scrooge in his accustomed voice, as near as he could feign it. "What do you mean by coming here at this time of day?"
"I am very sorry, sir. I am behind my time."
"Yes, I think you are. Step this way, sir, if you please."
"It's only once a year, sir. It shall not be repeated. I was making rather merry yesterday, sir."
"Now, I'll tell you what, my friend. I am not going to stand for this sort of thing any longer. And therefore, I am about to raise your salary."
Bob trembled and got a little nearer to the poker. "I'll raise your salary and endeavor to assist your struggling family, and we will discuss your affairs this afternoon over a bowl of smoking bishop, Bob. Now, make up the fires and buy another coal scuttle before you dot another I, Bob Cratchit." Scrooge was better than his word. He did it all, and infinitely more. And to Tiny Tim, who did not die, he was a second father. He became as good a friend, as good a master, and as good a man as this good old city ever knew. He had no further intercourse with spirits, but lived upon the total abstinence plan in this regard forever afterward. And it was always said of him that he knew how to keep Christmas well if any man alive possessed that knowledge. Oh, may that be truly said of us, and all of us. And so, as Tiny Tim observed, God bless us, everyone.
Charles Dickens' classic A Christmas Carol was narrated by Willem Lang of Etna, New Hampshire. The harp accompanist was Wendy Lee Barlow of Worcester, Ohio. This has been a production of Vermont Public Radio. The engineer was Sam Sanders. I'm Betty Smith.